Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from Petitioner Fleming Foods versus Sharp.
May it please the Court, Mr. James Cottonworth is presenting argument to the Petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Petitioner's refund claim in this sales tax case was denied solely on the basis that the limitations period had expired. Even though Petitioner and the Comptroller had entered into a series of written agreements on the promulgated form to extend the limitations period, the courts below held that Petitioner, not being a direct pay taxpayer, one who pays directly to the state instead of through its vendors, could not file a refund claim under Tax Code Section 111-104, and thus could not extend the limitations period under the extension agreement in Tax Code 111-203. And, Your Honors, it's a tax case, and there are all these code sections. For these two, which are the principal sections, in the future I will refer to as 104, which is the refund section, and just 203, which is the extension section, that are repeating 111 each time. The pre-tax code statute, old Article 1.11A, in its subsection 3, limited refunds to direct pay taxpayers. With the 1981 tax code, that changed. 104 has no such restrictions on who may apply for a refund. But the policy of the old law is still found in Comptroller's Rule 3.325B. which the Court of Appeals upheld over the admittedly clear language of the statute under the doctrine of legislative acceptance, even though it agreed that the language of the statute was clear and unambiguous.
Why aren't you aren't attacking directly the validity of the regulations. Why aren't you bound by them if you've not said they've got to be struck down?
We have attacked the validity of that regulation, Your Honor. We said the regulation is contrary to the statute and regulations are
real. You said it's contrary, but you haven't said that the control without authority and it's void and no effect. You just said that the statute trumps. But what am I missing here? You had not made a frontal attack on the ability of the controller to pass these regulations and say that they're void and without effect.
Well, it's because there is a two-prong attack here. It's the doctrine of legislative acceptance of the rule, which contradicts the statute, and it is also the argument which the Court of Appeals upheld that because the change from the pre-1981 law to the 1981 law was in a codification labeled a non-substantive codification, that controls over the language of the code as it is written. And so we are protesting it on both counts, Your Honor.
Could you explain to the court the difference between the direct pay taxpayers and Fleming? And
yes,
why
Your Honor.
That, are they both liable for unpaid taxes?
Your Honor, they're both pay the same taxes on the same purchases at the same rates. There's no difference in classification of taxpayer. Nearly all taxpayers pay their sales taxes as a part of the purchase price, pay it to the seller, also called retailer, also called vendor. That is in Tax Code Section 151052. It's a part of the purchase price. There is a specific set of provisions for what are called direct pay taxpayers in the current code. This is found in Code Sections 151, 417 through anyway. But they're very explicit, Your Honor, and what you do, you have to go through and get permitted to do this. It's restricted to very big taxpayers. You have to have annual taxable purchases of $800,000 or more, so very few people do this. And then when you buy something that is taxable, instead of paying the sales tax, you give an exemption certificate to the seller. And they keep that, so then when they get audited, they can explain why they didn't collect the tax. If you're a large taxpayer and you deal repeatedly with the same vendors, then instead of giving one each time, you give what is called a blanket exemption. And it's like a contract that says, we're going to be buying taxable items from you for this period, for this period. We are registered with the comptroller under these rules. We're going to remit the taxes directly to the comptroller, and therefore you don't have to collect them from us, and you can rely on this statement.
So Fleming...
Fleming has not elected to be a direct pay taxpayer. Fleming is a large wholesale food company that serves a lot of grocery stores, but it pays its sales taxes on its purchases as it makes them.
And then the vendor remits that to
the... And the vendor remits the tax to the state on a monthly basis. The applicable statute here is the extension of limitations statute, because this claim for refund was denied solely on the basis of limitations and on no other basis. At the end of this audit, Fleming paid some money on taxes it owed, and then it presented refund claims, some of which were allowed and then some of which were denied under the limitations rule. And we're protesting only the ones that were denied strictly for the limitations. And the basis of our argument is, you had a form, you presented it to us.
Can I ask you a question on the one refund applications that were paid? Was limitations a problem on any of those that was paid?
No, limitations was not a problem on the ones where they paid us.
So, in the mix of what's happened here, those payments are immaterial to the issue.
Those payments are immaterial, except that it acknowledges that we were paid refunds on taxes paid through our vendors.
Well, but under the state's viewpoint, that may be immaterial because they perceive the difference between being able to be an assignee of the right to the refund and being an entity that can or cannot sign an extension agreement.
But you would have to have the rights of an assignee in order to sign, execute a waiver of limitations for the taxpayer, and it is our contention that we are not assignees of the vendors, that Code Section 111-104F, among other code sections, makes a very hard distinction between vendors and taxpayers. Section 111-104B says that the person who paid the taxes can apply for a refund of erroneously or unlawfully collected taxes. Section 111-104C says it must be in writing and then provides some timelines. It provides some little procedural rules. And something that is new to the 81 Code completely. Oh, it was passed as a last-minute package for the old tax law, but with a prospective date, and then it was repealed when they found out they passed the new tax code, repealed the old laws. But along the way, as happens in the legislative process, they also put up a bunch of amendments to the old tax code with January 1st, 82 dates, and suddenly they had amendments alive for a law they had repealed and replaced with the tax code. But the first time it's appeared in a working statute, an effective statute, is in 111-104F. A vendor can only apply for a refund if it has already refunded in full to the taxpayers. So 111-104F does several things. One, it makes it very clear there's a distinction between the vendor and the taxpayer. That's not a distinction that's necessarily picked up on in the decision of the Court of Appeals. Two, whether 111-104F is a separate refunding provision for vendors, or whether it is a modification of 111-104B, the standard refund provision, but for vendors, we know that vendors can't get refunds until they have already refunded to the taxpayer. There are several logical consequences out of this. One, the taxpayer's rights can't be derivative of the vendor's. If the vendor has already refunded to the taxpayer, how could the taxpayer then apply to the state for a refund of the same taxes it's already recovered? It can't. Two, although 111-104B lets the taxpayer or its attorney, assignee, what have you, file the claim, 111-104F does not have assignment provisions. Like vendors don't have the right to assign their refund rights, such as they may be. And that's self-evident. To whom would they assign it? Other than having their lawyer file for it, they can't assign it to the taxpayer because they've already refunded to the taxpayer. Because of the language of 111-104F, it's very clear that taxpayers and vendors are different entities and that are treated differently. And it's very clear that taxpayers stand in their own shoes with regard to their rights and are not derivative of their vendors. Along with this, the refunds, I mean the extension limitation statute 203 says very clearly the comptroller and a taxpayer may enter into an agreement in writing to extend the statute of limitations for refunds, for credits, and for additional assessments for the same tax for the same periods. It doesn't say the comptroller and a direct pay taxpayer can do it. It says the comptroller and a taxpayer. It doesn't say the comptroller and a vendor can do it. And vendors clearly are different from taxpayers.
Now, in the facts in this case, the comptroller and the taxpayer entered into an extension agreement.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the extension agreement is a one-pager. It's written by the state. You can't alter it. And there's only signature space for the comptroller's representative and the taxpayer or its representative.
Now, there's an argument that the comptroller has a rule that said that they should have only done that with a direct payer. Is that what the argument
That's
is?
That's correct.
But it may be the comptroller violated its rule, but under the statute, it did have the authority to do so. And it did.
But except that rules have to be consistent, and the rule is applied on an ad hoc basis because we got some of our refunds back.
But still, the controller may not have followed its own rule, but it did do what was authorized under the statute, which was it did enter into an extension agreement on these other.
It entered into an extension agreement with us. And they're all in the statement of facts in the record. They kept coming back. This was a loan alert. And they kept coming back to extend, and we always signed and signed and signed.
I'm a little confused about your argument. A vendor, in the circumstances we have here, was the taxpayer from whom the amount was collected. Isn't that correct? Or is that
no, Your Honor, it's not correct because the vendor is not a taxpayer. The vendor is a remitter. Taxpayer is a defined term, section 101003 sub 8. It's the one liable for the tax. And 151052 says that the one who is liable for the tax, which means taxpayer, pays it as a part of the sale price. And 111016 says the person who collected it, which is the vendor, holds it as a trustee to remit it to
so
the state.
So your view is that the taxpayer name in most of the statutes that apply here can only be and is Fleming.
In this case, it would be Fleming. In a similar case, it would be
so
the actual taxpayer.
We don't really have an S&E or other successor. We just have this one entity.
We have this one entity. There are other reasons that
any other questions?
We're out of, I just noticed.
You have 5 minutes later.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. William E. Story will present argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Your Honors, this is a case to determine when and how sales tax refunds or credits may be claimed. And I have to begin, I think, by saying that Fleming has a basic misconception about who the taxpayer is. The vendor is just as much a taxpayer under the sales tax as the purchaser is, and perhaps even more so, because the whole sales tax, this works through the vendors. These are the people who need to get sales tax permits, who have to add the tax to their contract price if it's a taxable item. They have to give that tax to the state. They have to keep the records that show whether a transaction is taxable, and they have to submit to audits by the controller periodically to see whether tax was properly charged and paid over to the state.
How do you explain then the refund claims that were allowed?
Those are based on timely assignments, I believe, Your Honor, and I also should point out the record is really very sketchy. We do not have the audit in the record, and so I can't promise you that that's the only basis, but Fleming did get assignments from some of its vendors, and under the policy that it's the person who directly pays to the state who has the right for the refund or credit, it was necessary for Fleming as a purchaser to get those assignments in order to make their claim for the credit goods.
So your position is that I, as a consumer, am not a taxpayer of sales tax?
No, that's not true, Your Honor. You would be a taxpayer.
And if I'm a taxpayer of a sales tax and I've been improperly charged for sales tax that's been remitted to state, I don't have the right to a refund.
That you don't have a right to claim the refund directly from the state. Because the problem basically is when you're a purchaser, if you've been charged by your vendor a tax that didn't apply, you've got a problem with your contract price. You've been overcharged under your contract.
So I, as a taxpayer, I'm obligated to pay the tax, or I'm not. The state doesn't have the right to come for me as a consumer and get the sales tax that was not charged to me by the vendor.
In practice, we would not come to individual consumers, but where we have permitted businesses who are selling items, they will also be audited for their taxable purchases. But let me back up again and talk about...
Sure. You state the issue differently than Mr. Morris does. Mr. Morris says that the case is about who can agree to extend limitations, who can enter an agreement to do that under Section 203. And you just said it's who's entitled to a refund. Isn't this case really about interpreting the limitations provision?
That's probably the more significant question in some sense here. And I was
aren't both the claims that Fleming was complaining about, both that were denied because the comptroller took the position that limitations had not been extended in the statute?
Well, the Fleming's limitations were certainly extended, and it had refund and credit rights that went along with that. The problem is not in whether there was a balanced extension of limitations. The problem is in what were the substantive rights that were extended.
That's why I want to ask specifically your question, what your position is. You say that these extension agreements under 203A extended the state's right to come back and assess taxes on these very sales taxes we're talking about, but that it did not extend the time for refund. That was a one-size extension. Is that your position?
No, not exactly. Just
with respect to these taxes, is it one-sided or not?
But these taxes, of course, were already paid to the purchase by the purchaser to the vendor.
Were these subject to audit? Were you auditing these taxes?
And not the ones that were paid, because they were already paid. We were auditing similar transactions, which would be purchases where the tax should have been paid but was not paid.
But these taxes were still, the extension agreement still left open the possibility that you could have said you paid these sales taxes but they were not enough. You still owe more. The limitations?
Yes.
But by the same token, it did not extend the time for the taxpayer to say, no, I overpaid, I'm entitled to a refund.
Because that was not a right that they had in the absence of the assignment.
But my point is it was a one-sided extension agreement from that perspective.
Yeah, there is a different result. There is a different result there.
And so it's only an extension for the state, not for the taxpayer.
Well, no,
with
it's
respect
only,
to these taxes.
Let me try to illustrate it this way, because it's only an extension of the rights that the parties have. So let's say we have an injured person or we have a construction contract dispute. Now, the parties are trying to resolve that problem. But the time is running out. Now, they haven't given up yet, but their limitations are about to run. And so they say, look, maybe we can work this out. How about we agree to extend the time for filing suit on their claims for another 6 months? Well, they sign the agreement, but they don't reach an agreement of final settlement. All right, then the plaintiff sues. Well, the plaintiff starts to sue for some damages or some claims that are not recognized by tort or contract law. And they say, well, you agreed. I could file my suit for claims and damages. And the defendant says, wait a minute. I only agreed to extend the time. I didn't agree to give you a substantive right that you didn't have.
My point is, you by this agreement, the state, could have come back and said the taxes you paid, that you've already paid, were not enough, you're deficient. And that extension agreement applied to these sales taxes to allow you to come back and say they were deficient.
Different transactions.
Don't do it, these transactions.
No, they're different transactions. We're not increasing the tax on the prior transaction.
No, but you could have. The extension agreement would have given you the right to come in and say these very taxes that are deficient are deficient.
I guess, but there wouldn't be a way to have them have a credit available and have a tax at the same time. So, you know, if you just have one transaction, it's going to be taxable or not. And it's going to be taxable at a certain rate depending on where the sale is. So you couldn't simultaneously have a credit and additional tax on that transaction.
With respect to these sales taxes, Fleming says I overpaid. Conceivably, you could have come in and said, no, you underpaid. So even though you paid 3%, you should have paid 6%. So these sales taxes that you pay are deficient. And this extension agreement would have allowed you to come in and make that deficiency claim.
Yes.
But it would not allow Fleming to make the refund claim.
Yes, because the statute that allows them to claim the credit or refund requires that the person has directly paid that tax to the state. So if you are a purchaser who has paid a vendor, then you haven't paid directly to the state. And under the legislature's policy, not the controller's, that person is not able to get a refund or credit unless they have an assignment. And so,
which they later got.
They got them, yes. Then they got them well after the fact. Some were still good.
What's
some
the point of getting an extension agreement without the assignment?
Your Honor, that's an important point because, for instance, as I say, in audits, ordinarily we're looking at vendors. I mean, these are the people who have the frontline responsibility to send the tax to the state. And as you see in the refund statute, they don't get a refund economically because before they can get a refund of a tax that wasn't owed, they've got to give the money to the customer from whom they collected it. So I think as a practical matter, extensions are signed not because of an economic interest per se, but because it's in everyone's interest to have an orderly and accurate audit. It's the administrative sense that it makes for the business as well as the controller to have the controller make the most accurate assessment they can. That's the real consideration for the agreement.
Let me ask you a question. Do you agree with Mr. Morris that under your concept of the statute that the taxpayer could never... If, as you say, the vendor is the only taxpayer for the purposes of refunding, and this taxpayer has no right of refund without refunding to this other person, who would be the consumer, and the consumer can't get a refund from the state unless it gets this assignment, but the assignment, by definition, is extinguished. There could never be an assignment.
No. Not at all, because what happens is, who's going to keep the money? If the vendor is getting the refund money from the state, they'll have a double recovery unless they give the tax back to the purchaser.
Yes, but the vendor has no claim. The vendor has no claim against the state unless it has already refunded that money to the taxpayer. If it refunds the money to the taxpayer, then the vendor has a right to refund to itself, but the taxpayer has no right to a refund.
So
the taxpayer gets this assignment of a right of refund that's already been paid. The taxpayer, the defense would be, Mr. Taxpayer, you've been assigned this right, but you've already been paid. So there seems to be illogical here.
Well, here's the problem, I think. Once the vendor gives the tax back to the taxpayer is made whole. So the taxpayer isn't...
So there would be no assignment.
Well, there is an assignment because the vendor is typically the person who is directly paid to the state.
But the assignment runs from the assignment runs from the taxpayer, the real taxpayer, to the vendor.
No. It runs... The vendor is a person who directly paid. And under the substantive law, that you have to have directly paid its tax to the state in order to claim a refund. So let's say the purchaser, who is the person economically interested, wants to get the refund. But the legislature said you have to go to the person who's directly paid. They are the ones who get the assignment from the vendor. And then the purchaser can go forward with that assignment and get the money from the controller.
Maybe we're not communicating, and maybe I missed something.
Sorry.
Let's only the vendor can get the refund from the state.
Unless it's a direct pay taxpayer.
Okay. Only the vendor can get the refund from the state. That's your position?
In this circumstance, yes. Only the vendor gets the refund from the state.
But the vendor can only get that refund if the vendor has paid the original taxpayer the money back.
Yes. But the vendor's assignee can get the refund, which is where Fleming would be in this case.
But how can he be if he's the same one that's got the money back from the vendor in the first place? What would Fleming be an SE of under those circumstances?
Let me try it again. The vendor is either going to give an assignment to Fleming or it's going to give the money to Fleming. If the vendor gives the assignment to Fleming, Fleming comes to the controller and gets the money. If the vendor gives the money...
Okay, stop right there.
Yeah.
The assignment, the right that's being assigned is only valid if the vendor has paid the taxpayer.
No, the assignment, the vendor's assignment to Fleming is a substitute for giving the money to Fleming because...
Okay, so the vendor can assign it, whether it has, the vendor has either the right to go for a refund directly or it has under statute a right to assign.
Yes.
Okay.
And if they go for the refund directly, then, of course, they have to give the money to the taxpayer or else they get the donation.
So you disagree with Mr. Morris, who said that the only thing that can be assigned is the right of refund, but the right of refund is contingent on the vendor reimbursing the taxpayer. You disagree with his statement?
I certainly disagree with his characterization of it, because otherwise you'd have the purpose of getting a double refund. It doesn't work that way. What we have here is just a rule of privity, that if the state gets the money from someone, the state can give it directly back to that person. And if the state doesn't get it directly from that person, then the person has to go through the one that they were dealing with.
Let me ask the vendor.
Let me see if I understand something you answered earlier in response to one of Justice Owen's questions. Your view is that we can only interpret 203 by looking to what rights there are under 104.
Yes.
Is that right? We cannot interpret 203 separately using the definition of taxpayer that's elsewhere in the code.
Well, I would not say that. I think any taxpayer can extend limitations.
And only for himself.
Only for himself.
But what's the point in this case? Why would Fleming do it only for himself if he can't get the money?
I think one answer, again, is just the administrative sense of having an accurate audit. And they can get the money if they do it timely. Let me back up again. I was wanting to answer this.
Before you do that, let me clear up another fact. Do I understand that the audit that was accomplished in this case was an audit of Fleming and not the vendors?
Correct.
And that the comptroller determined that Fleming had underpaid when it transmitted money to the vendors. So that this audit is unpaid taxes from Fleming, and therefore why isn't Fleming the taxpayer? Because you're trying to charge him for non-payment. Or is it the next step? They're not worried about the claim that they've underpaid. They're saying we overpaid and we want our money back, and that's why we're in this controversy here today.
Fleming is a taxpayer, and the audit, I think, included both the purchases and sales that they made that they should have collected tax on. Again, we're very hindered here because we don't have a good record. We don't have the audit in there. When Fleming goes through the audit, it's going to be liable for assessment if it hasn't underpaid the tax. It may be entitled to credits or refunds if there are some transactions where it overpaid. For instance, if it had paid use tax to the state, which is a complement to the sales tax. Once they have paid it directly to the state, they are absolutely entitled to take that credit or refund. And the extension, back to your question, I think, Justice Hankinson, doesn't address the rights that they have. As the legislature has said, that the person entitled to a credit or refund is the person who has paid directly to the state.
But 203 says that the comptroller and a taxpayer may agree in writing to the filing of a refund claim.
That's correct.
And basically, if I'm the taxpayer and I'm not a direct taxpayer, I don't pay directly to the state,
When I stand in that agreement, it doesn't mean anything.
That's not correct.
It doesn't extend anything, it's not worth anything.
That's not correct at all. Because, and I'm going to try to go back to my illustration on the injured person or the contract dispute. We can extend the time, but I do not, when I extend the time, give you an expansion of your substantive rights. And that's what Fleming is saying. They're saying that they can read just the common language in the code, ignoring the fact that it is a codification and is supposed to continue the prior substantive law. And they're saying that what they really have is an expansion of their rights, not just an extension of time. That because of this agreement, they can come in and claim directly from the state a refund that the substantive law and the controller's rules say they can't claim.
No, they're saying that the extension agreement should apply to the right that they got by assignment later, which was the only reason for the extension agreement in the first place.
Right, and the problem there, of course, is the controller doesn't extend stuff that's expired. So by the time that
but it wasn't expired at the time.
But it was expired at the time, I believe. Some of them may have been, and indeed, there again, that's part of our problem in seeing records. When the assignments were presented to the controller, they were expired.
No, but limitations had not expired at the time that the agreement to extend was signed, had it?
Right, and had the
period for filing a refund claim expired at the time that the agreement was signed between Fleming and the comptroller?
No, but it wasn't an extension of rights that they didn't have. We only extended the rights that they did have.
If they had the assignments at the time of the extension agreements, they would be entitled to refund.
It would absolutely be a different case, Your Honor. And there is still, I think, a question under basic law of assignments whether it needs to be presented within limitations to the obligor under the assignment. We haven't briefed that issue, and if it's meaningful to the court, we certainly would. And again, that's not the case here. By the time they got any of these assignments, the vendor's rights, who were the persons who had paid directly to the state, were long expired. And at the time the extension agreement was signed, it could only extend the rights that Fleming had, not some that it didn't have. The controller couldn't really reasonably enter any agreement, and Fleming shouldn't interpret the agreement to read that the controller was giving Fleming new substantive rights, which under the law, statutory law, and which under the controller's rule, Fleming didn't have. It would be just as if you had your extension with an injured party. You could come in and maybe sue for reputation damages on a personal injury case. Well, when we agreed to extend the time for filing suit, we didn't agree that you had a broader scope of rights that were being extended.
If we disagree with you about your construction of the statute, and we conclude that when the legislature changed the law, they did substantively change it, and now there's no longer the direct taxpayer requirement, does that statute trump the controller's regulations or not?
No, Your Honor, because you still have to look at the rule. And when you look at the statute, first of all, it just says the person who paid the tax can claim. And frankly, it is ambiguous because it doesn't say to whom.
But let's say we held against you on that. You lose.
Okay.
We say that under the statute, Fleming is entitled to get a refund under the statute. How does that impact the regulations? Because the regulations there are clearly contrary to the statute. What trumps? Do the regulations govern or does the statute govern? Why?
Well, if you conclude that the rule is clearly contrary, I think that would be wrong. But if that's the conclusion that the rule is no good, then the rule would be no good.
Are you considering the case before us to challenge the validity of the regulations themselves?
No, it really hasn't been put in those terms.
Well, my question to you is, can we reach that issue? In other words, on the record before us, if we hold against you on the statute, should we therefore say the statute does trump the regulations in this case or not?
I believe, Your Honor, if the court's going to read the extension agreement to allow Fleming to make a refund claim, which in fact the rule doesn't allow, then there's only one way to go. You're either allowing the claim or you're not.
No, if the statute, I'm saying if the rule is contrary to the statute, which governs this claim, the statute or the controller's rule?
Well, the statute's always superior to a rule. The rule can only be not inconsistent with the statute. And I point out that it's this, I think, the legislative policy that the controller is trying to uphold here, because the whole point of a codification is that it carries forward the prior substantive law. And so if we're going to say that any old code can provide different law just because the words are different, it's going to be an awful lot of trouble.
What's the point of codifying if you have to go back to the old statutes and make sure that it means what you think it means?
Your Honor, I freely confess that it's awfully annoying when the code doesn't plainly carry forward the meaning that the prior law had. And I think that's one of the clear rationales the controller had for putting it immediately into his rule that, yes, the same substantive law applies. Yes, the purchaser doesn't claim the refund directly. You have to go through the person who paid the tax directly to the state. If we're going to say that any code is freely subject to reinterpretation despite the absolutely clear legislative intent that it might be, we're going to open up a big can.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
As I begin, Mr. Chief Justice, I was not informed before I appeared today whether the court had granted my objection to respondent's response to my reply brief or not. And in the time I have left, I need to know whether I need to respond to that document or whether it was struck as I pled.
We're carrying it with the case, so I feel the need to respond.
Very good, Your Honor. Okay. First, a part of the apparent confusion obvious in the dialogue today was pervasive in the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals did not distinguish between taxpayers and vendors. The Court of Appeals treated direct pay taxpayers, which under the present code is just the people who would pay directly under those complicated statutes and be licensed to do that, with vendors.
But you can see the old law did just that.
The old law, but not the new law, Your Honor.
And how do you respond to the code construction or the preamble that says this is simply a carrying forward?
Well, this court has a number of cases in the past several years because the legislature has a tendency to say this is a non-substantive recodification. If it says it's non-substantive and in fact there are no significant or meaningful changes, then the rules and rationales for the old law carry over unimpeded to the new law. But where there are significant changes, you have to go back to the primary rule of construction. We're looking for the intention of the legislature, and the intention of the legislature is best found and is found first in the language of the statute. There are significant changes here.
Cases, would you say recently that we have applied plain meaning in derogation of the...
May I step back and pick up mine? The language in Coastal Industries Water Authority versus Trinity Portland Cement says that the non-substantive change is honored only where, in fact, there are no significant changes. In City of LaPorte v. Barfield, they considered the non-substantive codification of the labor code on waivers of municipal immunity, but this court resorted to considerations of legislative history only after considering the wording of the statute, including the new labor code, and finding that the statutory language itself did not leave the court with an answer to a degree of reasonable certainty. In Texas-Mexican Railway versus Boucher, the court found that the old statute had been codified into the labor code without meaningful or significant changes in wording. But I think in the language in Coastal Industries Water Authority, where the court said that if there are no significant changes on a non-substantive recodification, the old interpretations carry forward. That's
where, we said the opposite, where we said the code, the preamble goes to the code says no substantive changes, but there are. And we have said, well, the plain meaning overrides the legislature's intent that there not be substantive. Have we actually held that?
You did in very recently in Jones v. Fowler. There, you were amending, the family code was amended by two bills, One said this is non-substantive change. That was House Bill 55. House Bill 433 said, but we're going to put these enumerated substantive changes into the non-substantive changes of the other House bill. And the statute that came before this court was on the mean, it was in custody of a child, was in the meaning on whether prior meant immediately prior, because the word immediately had been omitted. And the court said, well, there are substantive changes. This is not one of them. And then the court did what I would ask it to do in this case, and that is it then considered the statutory meaning in the context of the whole code and uses of it elsewhere and sought to find complementary uses and uniformity throughout the code. If it had been designated a substantive change, it would have been honored. In the language in Coastal Industries, it says if there's been no significant change, which means if there is a significant change, I think we'd have to look at it because that's where your legislative intention is found. The other things that I need to respond to, look, statutes of limitations have to have a policy of even-handedness, and this is particularly so in tax cases, because the audits are for particular tax reporting periods, and when it's over, it's over. And if somebody underpaid or overpaid, it's too late. And I don't see how the state can interpret its own extension statute and its own extension agreement, which it promulgates, and which only it and this taxpayer sign, which the vendor does not sign, can't sign. There's no provision for the vendor to sign it. To say, this keeps the door open for additional assessments, but not for refunds and credits.
Let me ask you, on the pages 9 and 10 of the respondent's brief on the merits, they assert that the assignments have attachments that have the dates of and the amounts of the taxes paid, and those aren't in evidence, and therefore you can't prove up your right to refund in any event. Could you address that?
Yes, I'll be glad to. When we went to trial on this, because it was a complicated fact situation, we stipulated everything. And in the trial court, we stipulated into existence the existence of the assignments of refund.
Would you send us a letter showing us where we could look in the record to find?
I'll be glad to. It's in my brief. I refer to them. They're in the statement of fact. They're in the transcript.
Okay.
They are in the transcript, but if you want me to send a letter, I'll be glad to do it.
If you'll just send us a letter addressing that specific
page. I'll be glad to do that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and second clause.